Sono uscito per scelta.
44.
32.
It's pretty obvious which warehouse we are looking for here. Fourth one on the left. The road that runs down toward the waterfront is blocked off by several shipping containers. The big steel boxes you see on backs of 18-wheelers. They are arranged in a herringbone pattern, so that in order to get past them, you have to slalom back and forth half a dozen times, passing through a narrow, maze-like channel between high walls of steel. Guys with guns are perched on top, looking down at YT as she guides her plank through the obstacle course. By the time she makes it out into the clear, she's been heavily checked out. There is the occasional light bulb on a wire strung around, and even a couple of strings of Christmas tree lights. These are switched on just to make her feel a little more welcome. She can't see anything, just lights making colored halos amid a generalized cloud of dust and fog. In front of her, access to the waterfront is blocked off by another maze of shipping containers. One of them has a graffiti sign. The UKOD says, "Try some countdown today." "What's the UKOD?" she says, just to break the ice a little. "Undisputed king of the ozone destroyers," says a man's voice. He is just in the act of jumping down from the loading dock of the warehouse to her left. Back inside the warehouse, YT can see electric lights and glowing cigarettes. "That's what we call Emilio." "Oh, right," YT says. "The Freon guy. I'm not here for chill." "Well," says the guy, a tall, rangy dude in his 40s, much too skinny to be 40 years old. He yanks the butt of a cigarette from his mouth and throws it away like a dart. "What'll it be, then?" "What does snow crash cost?"
1.75 gippas," the guy says.
"I thought it was 1.5, YT says.
The guy shakes his head. "Inflation, you know.
Still, it's a bargain. Hell, that plank you're on is probably worth 100 gippas." "You can't even buy these for dollars," YT says, getting her back up. "Look, all I've got is $1.5 quadrillion.
She pulls the bundle out of her pocket. The guy laughs, shakes his head, hollers back to his colleagues inside the warehouse.
"You guys, we got a chick here who wants to pay in Mises."
"Better get rid of him fast, honey," says a sharper, nastier voice, "or get yourself a wheelbarrow."
It's an even older guy with a bald head, curly hair on the sides, and a paunch. He's standing up on the loading dock.
"If you're not going to take it, just say so," YT says.
All of this chatter has nothing to do with business.
"We don't get chicks back here very often," the fat, bald old guy says.
YT knows that this must be the UKOD himself.
"So we'll give you a discount for being spunky. Turn around."
"Fuck you," YT says. She's not going to turn around for this guy. Everyone with an earshot laughs.
"Okay. Do it," the UKOD says.
The tall, skinny guy goes back over to the loading dock and hauls an aluminum briefcase down, sets it on top of a steel drum in the middle of the road, so that it's about waist height.
"Pay first," he says.
She hands him the Mises. He examines the bundle, sneers, throws it back into the warehouse with a sudden backhand motion. All the guys inside laugh some more. He opens up the briefcase, revealing the little computer keyboard. He shoves his ID card into the slot, types in it for a couple of seconds. He unsnaps a tube from the top of the briefcase, places it into the socket in the bottom part. The machine draws it inside, does something, spits it back out. He hands the tube to YT. The red numbers on top are counting down from 10.
"When it gets down to 1, hold it up to your nose and start inhaling," the guy says.
She's already backing away from him.
"You got a problem, little girl?"
he says.
"Not yet," she says.
Then she throws the tube up in the air as hard as she can. The chop of the rotor blades comes out of nowhere. The whirlwind reaper blurs over their heads. Everyone crouches for an instant as surprise buckles their knees. The tube does not come back to earth.
"You fucking bitch," the skinny guy says.
"That was a really cool plan," the UKOD says. "But the part I can't figure out is, Why would a nice, smart girl like you participate in a suicide mission?
The sun comes out. About half a dozen suns, actually. All around them, up in the air, so that there are no shadows. The faces of the skinny man and the UKOD look flat and featureless under this blinding illumination. YT is the only person who can see worth a damn because her night visions have compensated for it. The men wince and sag beneath the light. YT turns to look behind herself. One of the miniature suns is hanging above the maze of shipping containers, casting light into all its crannies, blinding the gunmen who stand guard there. The scene flashes too light and too dark as her goggles electronics try to make up their mind. But in the midst of this whole visual tangle, she gets one image printed indelibly on her retina. The gunmen going down like a tree line in a hurricane, and for just an instant, a line of dark angular things silhouetted above the maze as they crested like a cybernetic tsunami. Rat things. They have evaded the whole maze by leaping over it in long, flat parabolas. Along the way, some of them have slammed right through the bodies of men holding guns, like NFL fullbacks plowing full speed through nerdy sideline photographers. Then, as they land on the road in front of the maze, there is an instant burst of dust with frantic white sparks dancing around to the bottom. And while all this is happening, YT doesn't hear. She feels one of the rat things impacting on the body of the tall, skinny guy. Hears his ribs crackling like a ball of cellophane. Hell is already breaking loose inside the warehouse, but her eyes are trying to follow the action, watching the sparks and dust contrails of more rat things drawing themselves down the length of the road in an instant and then going airborne to the top of the next barrier. 3 seconds have passed since she threw the tube into the air. She is turning back to look inside the warehouse, but someone's on top of the warehouse catching her eye for a second. It's another gunman, a sniper, stepping out from behind an air conditioning unit, just getting used to the light, raising his weapon to his shoulder. YT winces as a red laser beam from his rifle sweeps across her eyes once, twice, as he zeroes his sights on her forehead. Behind him, she sees the Whirlwind Reaper, its rotors making a disc under the brilliant light, a disc that is foreshortened into a narrow ellipse, and then into a steady silver line. Then it flies right past the sniper. The chopper pulls up into a hard turn, searching for additional prey, and something falls beneath it in a powerless trajectory. She thinks that it has dropped the bomb. But it's the head of the sniper spinning rapidly, throwing out a fine pink helix under the light. The little chopper's rotor blade must have caught him in the nape of the neck. One part of her is dispassionately watching the head bounce and spin in the dust, and the other part of her is screaming her lungs out. She hears a crack, the first loud noise so far. She turns to follow the sound, looking in the direction of a water tower that looms above this area, providing a fine vantage point for a sniper. But then her attention is drawn by the pencil-thin blue-white exhaust of a tiny rocket that lances up into the sky from Ing's van. It doesn't do anything. It just goes up to a certain height and hovers, sitting on its exhaust. She doesn't care. She's kicking her way down the road now in her plank, trying to get something between her and that water tower. There is a second cracking noise. Before the sound even reaches her ears, the rocket darts horizontally like a minnow, makes one or two minor cuts to correct its course, zeroes in on that sniper's perch, up in the water tower's access ladder. There is a great, nasty explosion without any flame or light, like the loud, pointless booms that you get sometimes at fireworks shows. For a moment, she can hear the clamor of shrapnel ringing through the ironwork of the water tower. Just before she kicks her way back into the maze, a dust line whips past her, snapping rocks and fragments of broken glass into her face. It shoots into the maze. She hears it ping-pong all the way through, kicking off the steel walls in order to change direction. It's a rat thing clearing the way for her. How sweet. Smile. smooth move, Ex-Lax, she says, climbing back into Ing's van. Her throat feels thick and swollen. Maybe it's from screaming. Maybe it's the toxic waste. Maybe she's getting ready to gag. Didn't you know about the sniper, she says? If she can keep talking about the details of the job, maybe she can keep her mind off what the Whirlwind Reaper did. I didn't know about the one on the water tower, Ing says. But as soon as he fired a couple of rounds, we plotted the bullet's trajectories on millimeter wave and backtraced them. He talks to his van and it pulls out of its hiding place, headed for I-405. Seems like kind of an obvious place to look for a sniper. He was in an unfortified position, exposed from all sides, Ing says. He chose to work from a suicidal position, which is not a typical behavior for drug dealers. Typically, they are more pragmatic. Now, do you have any other criticisms of my performance? Well, did it work? Yes. The tube was inserted into a sealed chamber inside the helicopter before it discharged its contents. It was then flash-frozen in liquid helium before it could chemically self-destruct. We now have a sample of Snow Crash, something that no one else has been able to get. It is the kind of success on which reputations such as mine are constructed. How about the rat things? How about them? Are they back in the van now? Back there? Whitey jerks her head aft. Ing pauses for a moment. Whitey reminds herself that he is sitting in his office in Vietnam in 1955, watching all of this on TV. Three of them are back, Ing says. Three are on their way back. And three of them I left behind to carry out additional pacification measures. You're leaving them behind? They'll catch up, Ing says. On a straightaway, they can run at 700 miles per hour. Is it true they have nuke stuff inside of them? Radiothermal isotopes. What happens if one gets busted open? Everyone gets all mutated? If you ever find yourself in the presence of a destructive force powerful enough to decapsulate those isotopes, Ing says, radiation sickness will be the least of your worries. Will they be able to find their way back to us? Didn't you ever watch Lassie Come Home when you were a child? He asks. Or rather, more of a child than you are now? So, she was right. The rat things are made from dog parts. That's cruel, she says. This brand of sentimentalism is very predictable, Ing says. To take a dog out of his body, keep him in a hutch all the time. When the rat thing, as you call it, is in his hutch, do you know what he's doing? Licking his electric nuts? Chasing frisbees through the surf, forever. Eating steaks that grow on trees. Lying beside the fire in a hunting lodge. I haven't installed any testicle-licking simulations yet, but now that you have brought it up, I shall consider it. What about when he's out of the hutch, running around doing errands for you? Can't you imagine how liberating it is for a pit bull terrier to be capable of running 700 miles an hour? Whitey doesn't answer. She is too busy trying to get her mind around this concept. Your mistake, Ing says, is that you think that all mechanically assisted organisms, like me, are pathetic cripples. In fact, we are better than we were before. Where do you get the pit bulls from? An incredible number of them are abandoned every day, in cities all over the place. You cut up pound puppies? We save abandoned dogs from certain extinction and send them to what amounts to dog heaven. My friend Roadkill and I had a pit bull, Fido. We found it in an alley. Some asshole had shot it in the leg. We had a vet fix it up. We kept it in this empty apartment in Roadkill's building for a few months, played with it every day, brought it food. And then one day we came to play with Fido, and he was gone. Someone broke in and took him away. Probably sold him to a research lab. Probably, Ing says. But that's no way to keep a dog. It's better than the way he was living before. There's a break in the conversation as Ing occupies himself with talking to his van, maneuvering onto the Long Beach freeway, headed back into town. Do they remember stuff? Whitey says. To the extent dogs can remember anything, Ing says. We don't have any way of erasing memories. So maybe Fido is a rat thing somewhere right now. I would hope so, for his sake, Ing says. In a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong franchise in Phoenix, Arizona, Ing Security Industries' semi-autonomous guard unit B-782 comes awake. The factory that put him together thinks of him as a robot named number B-782, but he thinks of himself as a pit bull terrier named Fido. In the old days, Fido was a bad little doggy sometimes. But now, Fido lives in a nice little house in a nice little yard. Now he has become a nice little doggy. He likes to lie in his house and listen to the other nice doggies bark. Fido is part of a big pack. Tonight there is a lot of barking from a place far away. When he listens to this barking, Fido knows that a whole pack of nice doggies is very excited about something. A lot of very bad men are trying to hurt a nice girl. This has made the doggies very angry and excited. In order to protect the nice girl, they are hurting some of the bad men, which is as it should be. Fido does not come out of his house. When he first heard the barking, he became excited. He likes nice girls, and it makes him especially upset when bad men try to hurt them. Once there was a nice girl who loved him. That was before, when he lived in a scary place, and he was always hungry, and many people were bad to him. But the nice girl loved him and was good to him. Fido loves the nice girl very much, but he can tell from the barking of the other doggies that the nice girl is safe now. So he goes back to sleep. Excuse me, Pod, YT says, stepping into the Babel/Infocalypse room. Jeez, this place looks like one of those things full of snow that you shake up.
Hi, YT.
Got some more intel for you, Pod.
Shoot.
Snow Crash is a roid, or else it's similar to a roid. Yeah, that's it. It goes into your cell walls just like a roid, and then it does something to the nucleus of the cell.
You were right, Hiro says to the librarian. Just like herpes.
This guy I was talking to said that it fucks with your actual DNA. I don't know what half of this shit means, but that's what he said.
Who's this guy you were talking to?
Ing? Of Ing Security Industries. Don't bother talking to him. He won't give you any intel, she says dismissively.
Why are you hanging out with a guy like Ing?
Mob job. The Mafia has a sample of the drug for the first time, thanks to me and my pal Ing. Until now, it always self-destructed before they can get to it. So I guess they're analyzing it or something. Trying to make an antidote, maybe.
Or trying to reproduce it.
The Mafia wouldn't do that.
Don't be a sap, Hiro says.
Of course they would.
YT seems miffed at Hiro. Look, he says, I'm sorry for reminding you of this, but if we still had laws, the Mafia would be a criminal organization.
But we don't have laws, she says, so it's just another chain.
Fine. All I'm saying is, they may not be doing this for the benefit of humanity.
And why are you in here holed up with this geeky demon, she says, gesturing at the librarian.
For the benefit of humanity? Or because you're chasing a piece of ass, whatever her name is. Okay. Let's not talk about the Mafia anymore, Hiro says. I have work to do.
So do I. YT zaps out again, leaving a hole in the metaverse that is quickly filled in by Hiro's computer.
I think she may have a crush on me, Hiro explains.
She seemed quite affectionate, the librarian says.
Okay, Hiro says. Back to work.
Where did Ashera come from? Originally from Sumerian mythology. Hence, she is also important in Babylonian, Assyrian, Canaanite, Hebrew, and Ugaritic myths, which are all descended from the Sumerian.
Interesting. So the Sumerian language died out, but the Sumerian myths were somehow passed on in the new languages.
Correct. Sumerian was used as the language of religion and scholarship by later civilizations, much as Latin was used in Europe during the Middle Ages. No one spoke it as their native language, but educated people could read it. In this way, Sumerian religion was passed on.
And what did Ashera do in Sumerian myths?
The accounts are fragmentary. Few tablets have been discovered, and these are broken and scattered. It is thought that Elbaub Reif has excavated many intact tablets, but he refuses to release them. The surviving Sumerian myths exist in fragments and have a bizarre quality. Lagos compared them to the imaginings of a febrile two-year-old. Entire sections of them simply cannot be translated. The characters are legible and well-known, but when put together, they do not say anything that leaves an imprint on the modern mind.
Like instructions for programming a VCR.
There is a great deal of monotonous repetition. There is also a fair amount of what Lagos described as Rotary Club boosterism. Scribes extolling the superior virtue of their city over some other city.
What makes one Sumerian city better than another one? A bigger ziggurat? A better football team?
Better may.
What are may?
Rules or principles that control the operation of society, like a code of laws, but on a more fundamental level.
I don't get it.
That is the point. Sumerian myths are not readable or enjoyable in the same sense that Greek and Hebrew myths are. They reflect a fundamentally different consciousness from ours.
I suppose if our culture was based on Sumer, we would find them more interesting, Hero says.
Akkadian myths came after the Sumerian and are clearly based on Sumerian myths to a large extent. It is clear that Akkadian redactors went through the Sumerian myths, edited out the, to us, bizarre and incomprehensible parts, and strung them together into longer works, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh. The Akkadians were Semites, cousins of the Hebrews.
What did the Akkadians have to say about her?
She is a goddess of the erotic and of fertility. She also has a destructive, vindictive side. In one myth, Kerta, a human king, is made grievously ill by Asherah. Only El, king of the gods, can heal him. El gives certain persons the privilege of nursing at Asherah's breasts. El and Asherah often adopt human babies and let them nurse on Asherah. In one text, she is wet-nursed to 70 divine sons.
Spreading that virus, Hero says. Mothers with AIDS can spread the disease to their babies by breastfeeding them. But this is the Akkadian version, right?
Yes, sir.
I want to hear some Sumerian stuff, even if it is untranslatable.
Would you like to hear how Asherah made Enki sick?
Sure.
How this story is translated depends on how it is interpreted. Some see it as a fall from paradise story. Some see it as a battle between male and female, or water and earth. Some see it as a fertility allegory. This reading is based on the interpretation of Bent Alster.
Duly noted.
To summarize, Enki and Ninhursag, who is Asherah, although in this story she also bears other epithets, live in a place called Dilmun. Dilmun is pure, clean, and bright. There is no sickness. People do not grow old. Predatory animals do not hunt. But there is no water. So Ninhursag pleads with Enki, who is a sort of water god, to bring water to Dilmun. He does so by masturbating among the reeds of the ditches and letting flow his life-giving semen, the water of the heart, as it is called. At the same time, he pronounces a namshub, forbidding anyone to enter this area. He does not want anyone to come near his semen.
Why not?
The myth does not say.
Then, Hero says, he must have thought it was valuable, or dangerous, or both.
Dilmun is now better than it was before. The fields produce abundant crops and so on.
Excuse me, but how did Sumerian agriculture work? Did they use a lot of irrigation?
They were entirely dependent upon it.
So Enki was responsible, according to this myth, for irrigating the fields with his water of the heart.
Enki was the water god, yes.
Okay, go on.
But Ninhursag, Asherah, violates his decree and takes Enki's semen and impregnates herself. After 9 days of pregnancy, she gives birth, painlessly, to a daughter, Ninmu. Ninmu walks on the riverbank. Enki sees her, becomes inflamed, goes across the river, and has sex with her.
With his own daughter?
Yes. She has another daughter 9 days later, named Ninkura. And the pattern is repeated.
Enki has sex with Ninkura, too?
Yes. And she has a daughter named Utu. Now, by this time, Ninhursag has apparently recognized a pattern in Enki's behavior, and so she advises Utu to stay in her house, predicting that Enki will then approach her bearing gifts and try to seduce her.
Does he?
Enki once again fills the ditches with the water of the heart, which makes things grow. The gardener rejoices and embraces Enki.
Who's the gardener?
Just some character in the story, the librarian says. He provides Enki with grapes and other gifts. Enki disguises himself as the gardener and goes to Utu and seduces her. But this time, Ninhursag manages to obtain a sample of Enki's semen from Utu's thighs.
My God, talk about your mother-in-law from hell.
Ninhursag spreads the semen on the ground and it causes 8 plants to sprout up.
Does Enki have sex with the plants, then?
No, he eats them. In some sense, he learns their secrets by doing so.
So here we have our Adam and Eve motif.
Ninhursag curses Enki, saying, quote, "Until thou art dead, I shall not look upon thee with the eye of life," unquote. Then she disappears, and Enki becomes very ill. 8 of his organs become sick, 1 for each of the plants. Finally, Ninhursag is persuaded to come back. She gives birth to 8 deities, 1 for each part of Enki's body that is sick, and Enki is healed. These deities are the pantheon of Dilmun, i.e., this act breaks the cycle of incest and creates a new race of male and female gods that can reproduce normally.
I'm beginning to see what Lagos meant about the febrile 2-year-old.
Alster interprets the myth as, quote, "an exposition of a logical problem. Supposing that originally there was nothing but one creator, how could ordinary binary sexual relations come into being?"
Ah, there's that word binary again.
You may remember an unexplored fork earlier in our conversation that would have brought us to the same place by another route. This myth can be compared to the Sumerian creation myth, in which heaven and earth are united to begin with. But the world is not really created until the two are separated. Most creation myths begin with a paradoxical unity of everything, evaluated either as chaos or as paradise. And the world as we know it does not really come into being until this is changed. I should point out here that Enki's original name was Enkur, Lord of Kur. Kur was a primeval ocean, chaos, that Enki conquered.
Every hacker can identify with that.
But Asherah has similar connotations. Her name in Ugaritic, Atiratu Yami, means she who treads on the sea dragon.
Okay, so both Enki and Asherah were figures who had in some sense defeated chaos. And your point is that this defeat of chaos, the separation of the static unified world into a binary system, is identified with creation.
Correct. What else can you tell me about Enki? He was the En of the city of Eridu.
What's an En? Is that like a king?
A priest king of sorts. The En was the custodian of the local temple, where the Mei, the rules of the society, were stored on clay tablets.
Okay. Where is Eridu?
Southern Iraq. It has only been excavated within the past few years.
By Rife's people?
Yes. As Kramer has it, Enki is the god of wisdom. But this is a bad translation. His wisdom is not the wisdom of an old man, but rather a knowledge of how to do things, especially occult things. Quote, "He astonishes even the other gods with shocking solutions to apparently impossible problems," unquote. He is a sympathetic god for the most part, who assists humankind.
Really?
Yes, the most important Sumerian myths center on him.
As I mentioned, he is associated with water. He fills the rivers and the extensive Sumerian canal system with his life-giving semen. He is said to have created the Tigris in a single epical act of masturbation. He describes himself as follows, quote, "I am Lord. I am the one whose word endures. I am eternal," unquote. Others describe him, quote, "A word from you, and heaps and piles stack high with grain. You bring down the stars of heaven. You have computed their number," unquote. He pronounces the name of everything created.
Pronounces the name of everything created?
In many creation myths, to name a thing is to create it. He is referred to in various myths as expert who instituted incantations, word rich, Enki, master of all the right commands. As Kramer and Mayer have it, quote, "His word can bring order where there had been only chaos, and introduce disorder where there had been harmony," unquote. He devotes a great deal of effort to imparting his knowledge to his son, the god Marduk, chief deity of the Babylonians.
So the Sumerians worshipped Enki, and the Babylonians, who came after the Sumerians, worshipped Marduk, his son.
Yes, sir. And whenever Marduk got stuck, he would ask his father Enki for help. There is a representation of Marduk here on this stele, the Code of Hammurabi. According to Hammurabi, the code was given to him personally by Marduk.
Hero wanders over to the Code of Hammurabi and has a gander. The cuneiform means nothing to him, but the illustration on top is easy enough to understand, especially the part in the middle, which shows a seated man handing another man what looks like a stick and a hoop.
Why exactly is Marduk handing Hammurabi a 1 and a 0 in this picture? Hero asks.
They were emblems of royal power, the librarian says. Their origin is obscure.
Enki must have been responsible for that one, Hero says.
Enki's most important role is as the creator and guardian of the Mei and the Gishur, the key words and patterns that rule the universe.
Tell me more about the Mei.
To quote Kramer and Mayer again, quote, "They believed in the existence from time primordial of a fundamental, unalterable, comprehensive assortment of powers and duties, norms and standards, rules and regulations known as Mei, relating to the cosmos and its components, to gods and humans, to cities and countries, and to the varied aspects of civilized life."
Kind of like the Torah.
Yes, but they have a kind of mystical or magical force, and they often deal with banal subjects, not just religion.
Examples?
In one myth, the goddess Inanna goes to Eridu and tricks Enki into giving her 94 Mei, and brings them back to her hometown of Uruk, where they are greeted with much commotion and rejoicing.
Inanna is the person that Juanita's obsessed with.
Yes, sir. She is hailed as a savior because, quote, "she brought the perfect execution of the Mei," unquote.
Execution? Like executing a computer program?
Yes. Apparently they are like algorithms for carrying out certain activities essential to the society. Some of them have to do with the workings of priesthood and kingship. Some explain how to carry out religious ceremonies. Some relate to the arts of war and diplomacy. Many of them are about the arts and crafts, music, carpentry, smithing, tanning, building, farming, even such simple tasks as lighting fires.
The operating system of society.
I'm sorry?
When you first turn on a computer, it is an inert collection of circuits that can't really do anything. To start up the machine, you have to infuse those circuits with a collection of rules that tell it how to function, how to be a computer. It sounds as though these Mei served as the operating system of the society, organizing an inert collection of people into a functioning system.
As you wish. In any case, Enki was the guardian of the Mei, so he was a good guy, really.
he was the most beloved of the gods.
He sounds like kind of a hacker, which makes his Namsha very difficult to understand. If he was such a nice guy, why did he do the Babel thing?
This is considered to be one of the mysteries of Enki. As you have noticed, his behavior was not always consistent with modern norms.
I don't buy that. I don't think he actually fucked his sister, daughter, and so on. That story has to be a metaphor for something else. I think it is a metaphor for some kind of recursive informational process. This whole myth stinks of it. To these people, water equals semen. Makes sense, because they probably had no concept of pure water. It was all brown and muddy and full of viruses anyway. But from a modern standpoint, semen is just a carrier of information, both benevolent sperm and malevolent viruses. Enki's water, his semen, his data, his mei, flow throughout the country of Sumer and cause it to flourish. As you may be aware, Sumer existed on the floodplain between two major rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. This is where all the clay came from. They took it directly from the riverbeds.
So Enki even provided them with their medium for conveying information, clay. They wrote on wet clay and then they dried it out, got rid of the water. If water got to it later, the information was destroyed. But if they baked it and drove out all the water, sterilized Enki's semen with heat, then the tablet lasted forever, immutable, like the words of the Torah.
Do I sound like a maniac?
I don't know, the librarian says, but you do sound a little like Lagos.
I'm thrilled. Next thing you know, I'll turn myself into a gargoyle.
Any ped can get into Griffith Park without being noticed. And YT figures that despite the barriers across the road, the Falabella camp isn't too well protected if you've got off-road capability. For a skate ninja on a brand new plank in a brand new pair of night visions, hey, you have to spend money to make money. There will be no problem. Just find a high embankment that ramps down into the canyon, skirt the edge until you see those campfires down below, and then lean down that hill. Trust gravity. She realizes halfway down that her blue and orange coverall, fly as it may be, is going to be a real attention-getter in the middle of the night in the Falabella zone. So she reaches up to her collar, feels a hard disc sewn into the fabric, presses it between thumb and finger until it clicks. Her coverall darkens. The colors shimmer through the electropigment like an oil slick, and then it's black. On her first visit, she didn't check this place out all that carefully because she hoped she'd never come back. So the embankment turns out to be taller and steeper than YT remembered. Maybe a little more of a cliff, drop-off, or abyss than she thought. Only thing that makes her think so is that she seems to be doing a lot of freefall work here. Major plummeting, big-time ballistic styling. That's cool. It's all part of the job, she tells herself. The smart wheels are good for it. The tree trunks are bluish-black, standing out not so well against the blackish-blue background. The only other thing she can see is the red laser light of the digital speedometer down on the front of her plank, which is not showing any real information. The numbers have vibrated themselves into a cloud of gritty red light as the radar speed sensor tries to lock onto something. She turns the speedometer off, running totally black now, precipitating her way toward the sweet creed of the creek bottom, like a black angel who has just had the shroud lines of her celestial parachute severed by the Almighty. And when the wheels finally meet the pavement, it just about drives her knees up through her jawbone. She finishes the whole gravitational transaction with not much altitude and a nasty head of dark velocity. Mental note. Next time, just jump off a fucking bridge. That way, there's no question of getting an invisible chola shoved up your nose. She whips around a corner, heeled over so far she can lick the yellow line, and her night visions reveal all in a blaze of multispectral radiation. On infrared,
The Falabella encampment is a turbulating aurora of pink fog, punctuated by the white-hot bursts of campfires. All of it rests on dim bluish pavement, which means, in the false color scheme of things, that it's cold. Behind everything is the jagged horizon line of that funky improvised barrier technology that the Falabellas are so good at. A barrier that has been completely spurned, snubbed, and confounded by YT, who dropped out of the sky into the middle of the camp like a stealth fighter with an inferiority complex. Once you're into the actual encampment, people don't really notice or care who you are. A couple of people see her, watch her slide on by, don't get all hairy about it. They probably get a lot of couriers coming through here. A lot of dippy, gullible, Kool-Aid-drinking couriers. And these people aren't hip enough to tell YT apart from that breed. But that's okay. She'll pass for now, as long as they don't check out the detailing on a new plank. The campfires provide enough plain old regular visible light to show this sorry affair for what it is. A bunch of demented Boy Scouts. A jamboree without merit badges or hygiene. With the IR supered on top of the visible, she can also see vague, spectral red faces out in the shadows, where her unassisted eyes would only see darkness. These new night visions cost her a big wad of her mob drug-running money, just the kind of thing Mom had in mind when she insisted YT get a part-time job. Some of the people who were here last time are gone now, and there's a few new ones she doesn't recognize. There's a couple of people actually wearing duct-tape straitjackets. That's a fashion statement reserved for the ones who are totally out of control, rolling and thrashing around on the ground. And there's a few more who are spazzing out, but not as bad. And one or two who are just plain messed up, like plain old derelicts that you might see at the snoozin' cruise.
"Hey, look!" someone says. "It's our friend, the courier. Welcome, friend."
She's got her liquid knuckles uncapped, available, and shaken well before use. She's got high-voltage, high-fashion metallic cuffs around her wrists in case someone tries to grab her by same, and a Bundy stunner up her sleeve. Only the most tubular throwbacks carry guns. Guns take a long time to work. You have to wait for the victim to bleed to death. But paradoxically, they end up killing people pretty often. But nobody hassles you after you've hit them with a Bundy stunner. At least that's what the ads say. So it's not like she exactly feels vulnerable or anything. But still, she'd like to pick her target. So she maintains escape velocity until she's found the woman who seemed friendly, the bald chick in the torn-up Chanel knockoff, and then zeroes in on her.